The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burnrate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister and Guy Jafrady.
Hello, welcome to Burnrate, the Venture Insider podcast. I'm speaking here with Guy Jafrady about the startup scene with a focus on venture capital. We have arrived at episode 96 and are approaching the 100th episode. We are recording on May 20th at 9 o'clock in the evening. This podcast is sponsored by our partners Omnium and Upscale.ch. So Guy, what are today's topics?
Today in the news, we have the SEF Growth High Potential Award, or rather, who won it, then the positive developments in the Swiss crowdfunding market and mega early stage rounds, meaning financing rounds larger than 1 billion, which we are seeing more and more worldwide. The main topic revolves around rapidly successive financing rounds at different, meaning higher, valuations. And the listener question goes in the direction of, do legal AI companies still have a reason to exist when OpenAI, Anthropic, and so on keep getting better? And at the end, as always, we come to the transaction of the week.
Well, Guy, tomorrow are the Swiss startup days. Will you be there?
Absolutely. Every year, Bern is what you could call a home game for me. And this year, again, we have a panel together with Berner Kantonalbank and ARE Ventures, where we'll discuss when angels are good, whether they are even needed at all, and how to best get access to angels.
Very good, very exciting. All right, let's move to the news. In the first news story, we look at five Swiss scale-ups that were awarded the SEF Growth High Potential label by the Swiss Economic Forum. The label goes to companies with strong growth strategies and high market potential. It is intended to strengthen their visibility and credibility toward various stakeholders, such as customers, suppliers, or financing partners. The companies awarded were, I'll quickly read them out, Tiny Fish, Grape Insurance, GreenTech, Wally and BC Platforms. Five companies from very different sectors, ranging from fast casual sushi to employee insurance and body temperature sensors, all the way to payment infrastructure and real-world health data. Guy, what does this selection say about the Swiss scale-up market for you?
I would say it mainly shows how broadly positioned the Swiss scale-up ecosystem has become by now. We are not only talking about classic software startups here, but really about very different business models. Tiny Fish is scaling a compact takeaway sushi model with centralized production. Grape Insurance combines employee insurance with HR and payroll software. GreenTech comes out of ETH and uses sensors for applications in sports, heat exposure, and safety-critical professions. Then Wally is building a unified payment platform across online and offline channels, which is also very exciting. And BC Platforms works with federated infrastructure for health data. This shows that Swiss scale-ups are not only growing in hype sectors, but often through specialized technologies, clean processes, and also strong B2B use cases. Max, why is such a label even relevant for scale-ups? In the end, isn't it really just revenue and growth that count? Or am I seeing that wrong?
No, I'm also an absolute KPI fetishist. Revenue and growth are, of course, decisive. That's clear. But especially in the scale-up phase, it's also about trust. These companies need to win larger customers, build partnerships, secure financing, and often, hopefully, also expand and scale internationally. And a label like the SEF Growth High Potential label can help with that because it acts as a kind of seal of quality. It strengthens positioning toward these stakeholder groups I mentioned and also helps, for example, in employer branding when searching for suitable employees. In addition, the companies receive access to growth modules, expert coaching, a strategic assessment by professionals, and of course, access to the very strong SEF founder network. I myself worked there at SEF during my studies, and today I'm also active as a coach in the Upscaler program, and naturally also see the potential that this label actually brings with it. So for scale-ups, it is very valuable because they no longer only have to prove that their idea works. They simply have to show that they can scale professionally and repeatedly. All right, then let's look at the Swiss crowdfunding market after three rather weaker years, although it was also written as weak years. I wouldn't see it that way. Let's say after 3 years with somewhat more moderate growth, we are now seeing significant growth in the crowdfunding market again for the first time. According to the new crowdfunding monitor Switzerland by Lucerne University of Applied Sciences, total volume rose by 14% last year to 630 million Swiss francs. The market therefore remains below the record level of 2021, but clearly shows signs of recovery. Guy, what is the most important driver behind this recovery?
I naturally also looked at the report, and the most important driver is clearly crowdlending. It now accounts for around 75% of the total crowdfunding volume in Switzerland. Particularly strong in this area was real estate crowdlending. This segment grew by around 38% to 275 million Swiss francs. One reason for this is the stricter equity requirements for banks since the beginning of 2025. And this naturally makes bank financing for real estate developers more expensive or harder to access. As a result, alternative financing platforms such as crowdlending are increasingly coming into play and are therefore becoming more attractive.
And what about crowd supporting and crowd donating? There are many different forms of crowdfunding. Here we are talking about projects like donations or other support models.
Last year, there was also a positive development here. Crowd supporting and crowd donating grew again for the first time since 2020, namely by around 30% to 35 million Swiss francs. A remarkable 9,288 projects were financed in total. That's already a substantial number. Particularly strong was the sports and health category, which led the others with a volume of 13 million Swiss francs. It is also interesting that platforms are increasingly relying on new models such as sponsorship activities in which members, meaning sponsors, can participate in deciding how funds are distributed.
To summarize, one can say that the Swiss crowdfunding market is on the rise again. Total volume increased significantly last year. The growth mainly comes from crowdlending, as we learned from you, meaning real estate financing. And at the same time, crowd supporting and crowd donating are also recovering. Now for 2026, which we also researched, experts expect further growth, especially in real estate crowd lending. This makes crowdfunding in Switzerland more relevant again, both for companies and for private projects and alternative financing. In the third news story this week, we are talking about a trend in the venture capital market that is making headlines, especially in the AI sector, so-called mega seed rounds. According to PitchBook, a study that was published these days, some AI startups have recently raised seed financings in the range of $1 billion or more. Examples include Advanced Machine Intelligence by Yann LeCun, or World Labs by Fei-Fei Li, or also Ineffable Intelligence. At first glance, this sounds like a strong development, but many early-stage investors rather see it as a warning signal. Their concern is too much capital too early can harm startups because it can displace discipline, focus, and real product-market fit. Because startups then focus too strongly on the product and the tech instead of the market, because they have no pressure since they have so much capital sitting in the bank account. Eve, why do investors now view these huge seed rounds critically? As an investor yourself, how do you fundamentally assess this?
Well, I mean, it is naturally critical for all smaller investors already simply because of the size. Nobody can participate and it's an enormous bet. But the main point is also this: a large financing round is not in itself a good strategy. That has already been mentioned. I mean, discipline still has to be there. And more money does not automatically mean a better company. A higher valuation in the seed round also does not mean that the company has a higher chance of achieving a higher exit. And I think, especially in the seed phase, it's about learning as quickly as possible, talking to customers and finding out whether they really want the product being developed and whether it actually solves a real problem, meaning whether there is willingness to pay for the product somewhere. And if you don't have too much money, then you naturally try to use the little money efficiently. And therefore, you can also learn from inexpensive mistakes. And if a startup receives an extreme amount of capital very early on, then this automatically reduces the pressure somewhat to speak with customers. They maybe focus a bit less and perhaps also work a bit less efficiently, pay less attention to salaries, which are very important in the early phase. And ultimately, the mistakes from which you learn and on which you build the company become extremely expensive very quickly. And investors in the PitchBook article therefore also say that limited resources can even be very helpful because they force founders to set priorities, whereas too much money can lead to a team scaling quickly and getting somewhat distracted before it is even clear whether product market fit exists. Max, does this mean that large seed rounds are fundamentally bad, or is this mainly a phenomenon specific to AI?
I do think that there are special cases, particularly in AI. Foundation models, infrastructure, large research teams, as we have seen, computing power, meaning compute, has incredibly extreme requirements. It's simply very, very expensive and has become more expensive. Therefore, in individual cases, it can certainly be understandable to raise a lot of capital early. But if you look at it a bit more granularly, then these are more exceptions. This is not a blueprint for all startups. Across the broader US market, the median seed round is around $3 million. That shows how far removed these mega rounds actually are from reality or the normal market. The main problem is the signal it sends to other founders. If mega rounds are perceived as a model for success, then a kind of FOMO effect emerges, and founders may think they need to raise as much money as possible, even though they don't need it. We are already seeing some of that in Switzerland right now when we look at cases. But in the early stage, what counts is not the size of the round, but whether a startup can demonstrate real demand. In other words, product market fit.
So we can summarize it like this. Mega seed rounds in the AI sector generate a lot of attention, but are not automatically a sign of sustainable success. As investors, I would definitely also add ourselves to the voices in the PitchBook report. We also warn that too much capital too early can distract founders from what really matters. That means understanding customers, sharpening the product, and proving product market fit. For capital-intensive AI startups, a large seed round may make sense in individual cases. But for most founders, the key lesson remains. It is not the size of the financing round that determines success, but focus, discipline, and naturally the ability to build real traction with limited resources.
With Omnium, you close your financing round faster and more successfully. Our partner Omnium is an innovative platform for growth financing. Omnium is the one-stop shop for financing rounds because they offer a completely digital, streamlined, and cost-efficient process, including legal framework, investor KYC, and payment processing. Anyone raising with Omnium can choose to do a private round and use only the platform for their investment opportunity. Or they can choose the Private Round Plus with additional access to 10,000 registered investors. Anyone wanting to run a publicly visible round with the broadest possible reach chooses the public round, where the offer is made accessible to all investors. With Omnium, you close your financing round faster and more successfully. Do you want to scale your startup quickly and successfully, and not just grow? Then, the Upscaler program is exactly right for you. It gives you access to our large pool of founders, entrepreneurs, and suitable investors. More than 50 startups have already benefited from more than 500 workshops and scaled their business nationally and internationally. Would you also like to benefit from this personal and individual support? You can find all information at www.upscaler.ch.
Very good. Let's move on to today's main topic. We are talking about a phenomenon that fits very well with the current AI and venture euphoria, and also with the last news topic. Startups are raising increasingly larger financing rounds ever more quickly, sometimes directly after the previous round. In the past, a rhythm of 12 to 18 months between two rounds was normal. I can still remember it well. It wasn't that long ago. Then it became 9 to 12 months, later 6 to 9 months, and today we are seeing cases in which companies want to raise new capital again after just a few weeks or even days. These so-called fast follows raise an exciting question. Is this a sign of strong demand and major opportunities, or rather already a warning sign of possible overheating? We currently have an example, Core Automation, a young AI startup that apparently wants to raise several hundred million dollars again shortly after a large round, at a significantly higher valuation. Behind this are various factors. There is a lot of capital in the market for these startups, naturally also strong competition among investors. we are seeing that very clearly again now. And of course, there are also strategics participating in this sector, such as NVIDIA and similar companies, which are not only investing, but can also potentially become future customers or ecosystem partners, and therefore naturally also have a certain amount of power when it comes to investing. But this is exactly where the problem begins. Valuations often appear more clear-cut from the outside than they actually are. Sometimes the higher valuation of a follow-on round is communicated while a large portion of the capital actually flowed at lower conditions. That can create an illusion of demand, and this illusion can quickly become reality in the VC world. You know the saying, fake it till you make it. And people then communicate that they have already raised such and such an amount, although in reality, they are already at the next round and at a completely different valuation. Guy, when a startup raises capital again directly after completing a round, and I'm not necessarily talking about a convertible here, because that is certainly possible. I'm mainly talking about an equity round, meaning a proper capital increase. Is that more of a positive signal for you in the sense that a big market is emerging right now, or are you rather skeptical?
You know me, of course, and know what I'm going to answer here. I'm naturally skeptical at first. Why does someone want to call for a significantly higher valuation so shortly after already raising a lot of capital and now ideally also having a runway of 24 months or at least 18 months? But I'm not automatically negative either. I mean, you always have to look at things individually. A quick follow-on round can make sense if something substantial has changed between the rounds in a short period of time. For example, a huge customer contract came in or was signed, a major technical breakthrough was achieved, and a strategic partner joined in who massively accelerates sales or proves that potential, or there is a market window that must be used immediately. We also know cases, not necessarily at a massively higher valuation, but for a quick follow-on round where investors look at a round too late and then still need a few months for DD and it's too late for them to jump into the original round. Then such investors are admitted at a somewhat higher valuation due to the de-risking of the startup through additional runway. But that is not because milestones were reached. So that definitely also exists in the Swiss ecosystem. That is then called a second closing. We also frequently discuss that here. For me, one of the first questions I ask myself is, what has actually changed apart from the momentum if capital is being raised again so quickly and at a significantly higher valuation? The founders or fundraisers really need to explain very precisely why this new valuation is actually justified. And naturally, that then has to be verifiable in DD with corresponding contracts and breakthroughs. And especially in AI, it is of course clear that we are talking about enormous capital requirements, compute, talent, distribution. Everything in this sector costs an enormous amount of money, but capital requirements alone do not justify a valuation. Personally, I am not a fan of founders using dilution from a financing round as justification for a valuation. That is not an intrinsic value, but only a strategy for the next financing round. And if you raise 3 million more or twice as much, then the valuation should also be significantly higher if that is being used as the basis for the valuation. What matters to me is whether the additional capital creates a real advantage or merely serves to continue extending the hype.
The question is, technically speaking, if you have a pre-money of 15 million and then you raise 3 million, you are at a post-money of 18. And then the question is, if you do another round 1 month later, what valuation do you use now? Do you again use the 15? Because you already closed, the capital increase has been implemented. Everything was also reflected in the cap table as well as in the registers and so on, in the share register and so forth. And now you probably go ahead and take the 18 million post money. That would probably still be more defensible. Although even there, if it's only 1 month later, there are question marks. What fundamentally changed in that time? But if you go even higher than the post money and say, now I'll do 25, then I agree with you. That is probably rather questionable. But do you fundamentally also see a danger for pricing discipline in the venture market if these fast follows become the order of the day?
Absolutely. Pricing discipline in our market is the be-all and end-all for success. And I would say it is not always given anyway. There are many investors who don't pay close attention to valuations. Maybe we are a bit pickier here and look at them very carefully so that in the end, we can also deliver returns for the LPs. That is the foundation of a VC fund. In that sense, we are the extended arm of the LPs and want to be able to generate good returns for them. The problem is that these rounds don't act in isolation. If a startup gets a valuation 4 times higher after a short time, then it immediately becomes a comparison point for other founders, and not only in the same sector. Then arguments come up like, if they got that valuation, why shouldn't we? Our startup is actually much better and solves the problem in a better way. We know that well. Every founder is very convinced of their idea and knows why it is better than the competitors. And through this, new pricing anchors emerge that often have less to do with fundamentals than with scarcity, attempts to generate FOMO and signaling effects. And if investors don't want to miss the rounds, then in the end, they have to play along or negotiate very well with the founder. And the founders then naturally see themselves in a strong position and don't want to sell below market. And suddenly the entire price level shifts without any real fundamental added value behind it. And that is definitely dangerous in boom phases. In such times, it may appear rational because there is always someone willing to enter at an even higher price. We saw that very clearly in 2021 and 2022. But eventually, the company has to actually grow into that valuation. And if that doesn't happen, then down rounds arise, difficult cap tables and disappointed expectations among employees who received ESOPs at high valuations, as well as investors who entered late. Then you get a downward spiral, and I hope we don't fall back into that again too quickly. We are actually only just emerging from the last downward spiral we had in 2023 and 2024. And for me, pricing discipline is therefore especially important in such markets. Not because one shouldn't make bold bets, but because you really need to understand what you are actually paying for. Is it traction or merely access to a hot story? Hey, I'm part of it and can now show in my deck to the LPs that I was able to invest in OpenAI at X 100 billion. Max, how do you see it? Is this mainly an AI-specific phenomenon because there is currently such an enormous capital requirement, or because strategic interest has also entered the market? Or are we seeing a pattern here that returns in every boom cycle?
Before I answer, maybe one more addition. I mean, it's always funny when a startup comes to me and says, we would be looking at a valuation of 50 million. Okay. And you know I come from valuation work. I once had the opportunity to run a valuation firm. And then my question is always, okay, how exactly did you arrive at this valuation? And the most common answer from the startup is because someone paid that price. And I say, okay, but that still isn't an actual derivation of the valuation. And then the answer comes, ask that investor. Okay, fine. Then I go to that investor. So, dear lead investor, how did you arrive at the valuation? And very often the answer is something like, we don't disclose that, or comparables were used, or a DCF on steroids. But actually showing how they valued it, that is very rare. And I really think that's a problem in the industry. I mean, sure, you can argue supply and demand. And if someone pays that price, then that's the price. But for us, it's a huge problem because there is always someone who thinks an incredibly high price is justified. And for the startup, it then isn't necessarily about finding the best investors, but simply those willing to pay the highest price. Meaning, whoever searches long enough will find someone. They simply keep searching until they find someone who accepts the valuation they want. And I don't think that is necessarily a healthy development. But again, you can look at it from two sides. You can also say, if someone pays it, then that's the market. But as you also said, at some point the rebound comes. At some point you have to grow into the valuation. At some point comes the day of reckoning. And if you are still loss-making then and suddenly need to do a down round and you have no anti-dilution protection, which is often the case, then good night. Then it becomes much less fun. Regarding AI, yes, it is mainly an AI topic. It is a major accelerator at the moment. There it is effectively the case that exactly this is happening because they simply need an insane amount of capital. And what is fascinating about AI startups is that they don't really scale when they are young. It's actually the opposite scaling. They need more and more compute. That's the funny part. We want to scale. Yes, exactly. In the first 3 or 4 years, you scale negatively. You need so much money and capital, and the larger you get, the more capital you need. And then naturally, after a few months, they come back and say, hey, we've grown incredibly, but now we need 5 times more cash. And for a small fund, that may be suboptimal. If you are Andreessen Horowitz, no problem. Then you probably already reserved 30 million for the startup anyway. Exactly. But still, it is a pattern we know from previous boom cycles. In every phase where a lot of capital meets a few supposed winners, financing rounds become faster, valuations more aggressive, and narratives naturally also become very important. How do you sell the whole thing? That is also a sign of strength. And later one often realizes that part of it was also a bit of self-congratulation, which is then rather suboptimal. Yes. If you now look at this situation from an investor perspective, what would a startup specifically need to show for you to consider a quick follow-on round truly justified? And from what point onward would it seem more like financial engineering than real company development to you?
I noted down three things here that a startup would have to show if they come with a follow-on round at a higher valuation. First, there has to be a real change since the last round, meaning not just more attention or new conversations, but measurable progress. I already mentioned it before, customer revenue, product maturity. It can also be technical performance or a new strategic advantage that didn't previously exist. It could even be a court case victory. We often see that with American companies where there are ongoing legal disputes, and if they emerge successfully from one of those, that can naturally also be a valuation trigger. Second, there has to be a very clear use of capital. If a company can say, with this money, we secure additional compute for 18 months, we continue building sales in three core markets, or we make an acquisition that massively accelerates us, then that is something entirely different from, hey, there's still some money lying around on the street. Let's just raise it because it's currently available. Third, and I also noted this down as very important, is the quality of the demand, meaning who is investing and under what conditions. If the external communication suggests a high valuation, but the economic reality of the round is far more complicated, then I become very cautious. Then it quickly becomes signal management rather than substance. And for me, financial engineering begins where the round primarily serves to produce a higher valuation rather than solve a real operational problem. A strong company can raise money very quickly, but a quick round does not automatically make the company strong.
That's a good concluding statement. I basically see it exactly the same way. In the end, valuations have to be justified through real development, through revenue and product progress or market position, and not merely through the next or a larger round. I think that is a very important conclusion. All right, let's come to this week's listener question. It comes from Till, and he asks, I'll quickly read it out, if models from Anthropic, OpenAI, and others become increasingly powerful and can more and more easily be applied to specific industries, do specialized legal tech companies still even have a real chance? Till, I assume you either work as a startup in this area or as a lawyer, or are generally interested in the topic. Definitely a very interesting question. The legal AI scene is currently heavily debating whether classic legal AI is already over again. Legora, for example, one of the most hyped European legal tech startups, no longer speaks about legal AI, but about agentic law, meaning not just AI that makes lawyers more efficient, but systems that take over entire legal workflows. Research, document review, DDs, meaning due diligences, playbooks, precedents, client history, all orchestrated through various agents in operation. At the same time, there is the big question, the elephant in the room. If Anthropic or OpenAI are already building the best foundation models anyway, why do we still need specialized legal tech providers? Won't they simply get overrun by the large LLM providers? Guy, let's dive right into it. How do you see this? Is legal tech as an independent category currently at risk because the big LLMs are moving ever deeper into these lucrative verticals? Or are we underestimating how much value truly lies in specialization? For example, in security, accuracy, workflow integration, or also customer proximity?
There are two levels here that we need to briefly look at, in my opinion. On the one hand, there is naturally the model layer, and here specialized providers hardly have a chance of being faster or cheaper than Anthropic, OpenAI, or Google, or the other large generalist model providers. These companies have the data centers, the talent, the data pipelines, and naturally also the corresponding capital base. We discussed that in depth earlier. But legal tech companies may not win on the pure model layer, but rather on the application layer, meaning the use case. Law firms do not simply buy a good model. They buy trust, liability reduction if that is possible, and they want software integrated into existing workflows. They want to map rights and role concepts, and auditability is also a very important topic I noted down. Document management is extremely important, and also the firm-specific playbooks that every law firm has. And if someone additionally understands how an M&A due diligence or litigation process actually works and can map that through the use of AI, then that naturally becomes extremely exciting. For law firms, it is also important that their data is not used for general model training and therefore flows into the general knowledge pool, because that is essentially their core IP, and therefore they also require on-prem solutions or attack-resistant proprietary cloud layers where they can be sure, we are working with our own data. This is exclusive to our IP and only we work on it. That is the difference between Claude, which can analyze a contract very well and provide good feedback, and the other case where the system is deeply embedded in the working methods of a law firm and the law firm can work securely with its existing data. And in that second case, I definitely see potential for legal AI companies. Max, would you therefore say that in the end, this is a classic question of distribution and lock-in? Meaning, who sits closer to the customer and becomes part of the law firm's daily workflow? Is it the large LLM platforms or the specialized legal tech providers after all?
I think the decisive question is, who controls the workflow? So if Anthropic only provides the model, but Legora or Harvey or other legal tech providers, we also have one or two in Switzerland, provide the interface, the data rooms, the playbooks, or can also control the approval processes, then there is still a lot of room left for specialized providers. But the pressure is brutal. So just in quotation marks, we make ChatGPT for lawyers. That is definitely no longer enough, I think. These companies have to prove that they are more than a nice interface on top of a foundation model. They have to go deep into the legal organization, almost like Palantir with the forward deployed engineers. So you have to understand things on site, configure, adapt, and thereby become difficult to replace.
And let's briefly summarize that, Till. Interesting question. In our view, legal AI is definitely not dead yet, but generic legal AI wrappers probably really do belong to the past and have little chance of success. The next phase belongs to companies that build real legal infrastructure out of AI, secure, precise, embedded, and close to the customer. And that is exactly where it will ultimately be decided whether legal tech can differentiate itself from Anthropic, so to speak, or whether it will be eaten by them. So, let's move on to the transactions of the week. Several transactions were communicated again last week, and we have briefly prepared the most important ones for you. Let's start right away in Zurich. Mosaic, a deep tech startup from the ETH Zurich environment, has now closed a pre-seed round of $3.8 million. The round was led by Founderful with participation from Kickfund. The founders bring deep know-how in system-on-chip architectures.
Mosaic develops perception chips that are intended to enable devices to see and understand their environment in real time, and to do so with very low energy consumption. The core is to process visual position data directly on a specialized chip instead of using very energy-hungry processors or GPUs for that. This should allow devices to create local maps of their environment, recognize objects, or remember where something was last seen, for example.
Like the question that often comes up, where did I put my mobile phone again, for example?
And exactly.
Mosaic's direct customers are mainly ODMs, meaning original design manufacturers that develop hardware for smart devices. Applications such as smart glasses, wearables, and other battery-powered consumer devices are particularly exciting, where form factor and energy consumption are extremely critical. In its first year, Mosaic has already generated relevant revenues through NRE contracts with ODMs, meaning through specific engineering customer projects.
What I find exciting is that Mosaic is not simply selling a chip, but wants to build a complete spatial intelligence layer for device manufacturers. The chip comes with an application layer that Mosaic develops and maintains itself, so that ODMs do not have to build everything from scratch. That addresses a real bottleneck. Many devices could benefit from spatial intelligence today, but but until now, power, size, and integration effort were simply too high.
With the capital, they want to advance chip development, flowing into product maturity and into initial commercial integrations. Strategically, the goal is to move from these initial NRE revenues that we mentioned to scalable product revenues through chip sales. If Mosaic manages this transition, then the company could become quite an exciting enabler for the next generation of smart glasses and spatial computing devices.
Good. The second transaction, we move into the medtech health AI space. Moonlight AI has closed a seed round of $3.3 million. The round was co-led by Lotus One Investment from Singapore, VP Venture Partners from Switzerland and Medin Fund from Tunisia, with participation from NV Capital and the existing investor Kai Ventures. In terms of content, this is an early but very focused AI diagnostics case for hematology and pathology.
I find what Moonlight is developing here very exciting. They are developing image analysis software for clinical diagnostics. The platform uses computer vision to detect indications of genomic biomarkers and complex disease signatures from routine blood and cytology smears. The big point is that instead of always waiting for expensive and slow next-gen sequencing processes, laboratories should be able to gain usable diagnostic insights faster from images they already use anyway.
Who are the target customers? These are mainly clinical laboratories, hematologists, and pathologists who want to make cancer diagnostics faster and more scalable. Moonlight is working with an international consortium of clinical partners to build a proprietary data library. This database is intended to link whole slide imaging of cytopathology samples with high-quality genomic data and thereby create the foundation for robust models in real laboratory environments.
And they position themselves between AI diagnostics and precision oncology. That is also an interesting positioning. Many oncology workflows today depend on expensive NGS analyses with longer turnaround times, and Moonlight AI is trying to bypass this bottleneck by translating existing standard images into diagnostically usable signals. That is attractive because the solution does not require completely new hardware and can therefore potentially and hopefully also be integrated faster into existing laboratory processes.
How will they use the money mainly for expanding the data library? Then team growth is a topic and also the further development of diagnostic solutions. In addition, the financing is intended to accelerate the path toward commercialization and regulatory approval.
Let's go to Lausanne for the next transaction, and this one is an exit. NIRLAB, a spin-off from the University of Lausanne, founded in 2021, has now been acquired by the US company 908 Devices. For once, the purchase price was communicated, and it is $23 million, 15 million upfront, 13 in cash, 2 in shares, and up to 8 million additionally in shares upon reaching certain milestones.
Whether that is a lot or a little, we cannot yet say. We may have to go a little bit in medias res. It does not look like very much money right now, but maybe they raised almost no money. Then it would again be a success. What does NIRLAB do? They develop handheld near-infrared spectroscopy devices for chemical analyses in the field. Through a mobile app, the device can apparently identify substances within seconds, including more than drugs such as cocaine, even through thin plastic bags or even through glass, I was told. In addition, the platform can also determine the purity of complex mixtures, such as with THC, or also analyze CBD proportions.
The most important customers are law enforcement organizations, as one can imagine. So the police, customs, and other authorities that have to and want to identify substances directly in the field quickly and safely. According to the company, the technology has already been used in more than 1 million field analyses. Whether that is a lot or a little, you can ask yourself when you look at how many people pass through an airport. But in any case, it shows that NIRLAB is not simply a laboratory innovation, but has already achieved practical use in day-to-day operations.
And the strategic fit with 908 Devices is obvious. The US company specializes in handheld chemical analysis and brings a global commercial infrastructure as well as a complementary product portfolio. For the American company, NIRLAB expands the offering in the area of rapid on-site screenings, and for NIRLAB, in turn, the deal means access to a larger sales channel and an established platform in the law enforcement market.
Strategically, this creates a new end-to-end offering here. Rapid substance screenings with NIR, meaning near-infrared technology. This is combined with further trace-level analysis and broader chemical detection through the devices from 908 devices. For the Swiss ecosystem, this is another deep tech exit. Unfortunately, not a unicorn outcome, but at least a clear industrial M&A deal with an international buyer.
Good. As the last transaction this week, we are also including the exit of Curly in the program. Curly is known for high-quality dog harnesses and dog accessories. The company was founded 16 years ago by Mark Zimmermann and Roland Primus in Herleberg near Zurich and has now been acquired by the Swedish outdoor group Thule. The purchase price is initially 10.1 million Swiss francs. In addition, up to 6.8 million Swiss francs can be added as an earnout, depending on future financial figures.
Curly develops and sells particularly lightweight, comfortable and easy to use dog harnesses. So that means harness systems that are strapped around the dog's chest and back instead of simply using a collar. The founders originally come from mountaineering and transferred their experience with harnesses to dog products. Curly is particularly strong in the premium segment for vest-style harnesses, especially for small dogs.
Curly sells through retailers in around 60 countries, so 6-0. That is quite a lot, with a focus on Europe and North America. Last year, it generated revenue of a good 6 million Swiss francs with a strong EBIT margin of 20%. That shows Curly is no longer a classic startup, but a profitable niche company with international distribution.
If we take the numbers, what is quite interesting is the valuation and the strategic fit, the initial purchase price. It corresponds to roughly 7x EBIT from 2025, and if the maximum earnout is achieved, the multiple, according to the press release based on EBIT in 2027, should also be at around 7x. Curly fits well into Thule's portfolio because dog transport products are one of the group's fastest growing categories.
The founders are expected to continue holding their roles within the group. This case is also not a classic VC exit, but a clean strategic M&A deal of a profitable niche player. So that was it with Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. If you want to support our podcast, subscribe to the newsletter and share it in your network. Many thanks for listening. We wish you a nice Pentecost weekend. Take care and goodbye.